that you're the creator of heavens and earth, Lord, that you're the God that loves us and you're the God who died for us. Help us to use these studies, Lord, to just make us fall more in love with you, to let us be even more sure that your word is true, that you are who you said you are, which is what it's all about. Just help us to turn our eyes to you as we look again at some more facts of science, Lord. Let us just be in awe of the Creator and not just be in awe of your creation. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. I had a good friend die yesterday. So I'm preparing for this study. One of the things that just kind of touched upon me is, I used to be pretty excited about Earth's magnetic field and a lot of this physics stuff, and it was just really cool, but it's really not all that important. The very beginning, I didn't really want to do this series of studies again. I did it before, about 3 years ago. And it's like, I just didn't want to do it again. Because it's easy to get drawn into this kind of stuff. It's really interesting. I mean, cosmology, theories about the universe and stars and how they form and the different things that are going on. So it's easy to get drawn in, but yesterday, again, one of the lessons that I learned is anything that draws you away from Jesus, even for a day, is not worth doing. So the reason why we're still doing these studies is, again, hopefully I made this clear in the first week, is that the Bible's true. God is God, in the beginning God. We'll go through that a little bit when we get to what the Bible has to say about creation. So the reason why it's important is to let us realize to not be as I was when I first got saved. And it was ashamed of the gospel. Just like Paul says, for I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. There is the power of God to salvation for those, for the Jew first and also for the Greek. Obviously that wasn't in my notes because I just blew the verse. But it struck me, again, one morning in Okinawa, driving up the hill. I just felt like I was saved, I was born again, I was going to heaven, but my life really wasn't changing the way that I wanted it to. And it's like, I'm a Christian, but I don't know if anybody knows that, other than the people at church, because when I act like a Christian at church, hey, brother, lots of hugs, and we called each other brother and sister in Okinawa, the church that I went to. But at work, I mean, maybe they saw that I wasn't quite so angry, or maybe my language is changing a little bit, but not much fruit, as in a lot of people whose lives just radically change. But as I was driving up a hill on my way to work in Okinawa, Japan, at Kadena Air Base, what struck me was a question. And again, as Pastor Rana said, I believe that God speaks to us. I believe He speaks most clearly through His Word. That we'll be reading a passage of Scripture, maybe we've even read it a bunch of times before, but all of a sudden, it'll have new meaning, and it'll be as if that was written just for us, just for today. Well, in the same way, as I was going up the hill, a question came to me, and it said, I was asking, I wonder why I'm not, I'm saved, I'm reading the Bible, and I'm going to a couple of Bible studies a week, and I'm doing all this stuff. Why don't I feel any better? Why am I not having more fruit in my walk? And the question that came to me is, are you ashamed of being a Christian? Are you ashamed of the gospel? And what I, of course, hope is, no, I don't think that's it. Surely that's not it. I don't want to be ashamed of the God who died for me, but I was. At the time, again, my bachelor's degree is in geology. Evolution is not a subject for rebuttal in most universities, especially in geology programs. It's taken for granted. So I never questioned it real hard. But the point I was going to make is I was ashamed of the gospel. God gave me chances to grow in that. Again, the first time I've shared with you before, I believe, the lawyer that I spoke to, incredibly smart guy, smarter, much smarter than me, again, which is not a huge leap of faith to believe, but didn't believe in God, didn't see how Jesus dying on the cross 2,000 years ago had anything to do with him today. So I got a chance to try to share that with him. What I realized is I'm not good enough at knowing what it's about to be a Christian to be able to explain to people, because some people won't hear Scripture. Now, I still think that's the answer. The answer is God. But because I've had people say, don't try to tell me what the Bible says. I think it's false. I think it's written by men. I think it's historically inaccurate, and I think it's full of contradictions. You could do what my lawyer friend, who I wrote his name in the front of my Bible, and I pray for him almost every day, many days. That's what I want to. But what he called it is, when Christians are asked a question that they can't answer, they invoke the faith clause, which is, you just got to have faith and believe. And I said that at one point in our discussion, because I didn't know how to explain some aspect of Jesus' atoning death on the cross. And he goes, that's what I mean. When Christians are confronted with a logical flaw in what they believe, they invoke the faith clause, which is, you just got to have faith. And what I told him was, you know, I didn't do a good job of explaining to you what it's all about, so let me go back and do some research and explain it to you in a letter. So I went back and trying to figure out what Jesus dying on a cross means for us today. Again, he had two problems. One is the evil God hypothesis, that is, how could a loving God with evil in the world, a God who is a creator, that God either created evil and is therefore evil, or allowed evil to be created and is therefore partly evil. And the short answer to that question is, God is a God outside space and time. God's good, perfect, and pleasing will be done through man's sin. We drew sin into the world. Bad things happen at a specific time in a specific place, that good may eventually occur. God's good, pleasing, and perfect will. It's hard for us to understand when we're looking at it in statistics, you call it N equals 1. With my experiences is what I'm interested in, my observations, it's hard for us to understand. But I wasn't able to explain it to him well, so I tried to explain a little better then. And the second one, which is a rich opportunity to share the gospel, is if you didn't see how a man dying on a torture device 2,000 years ago had any practical application for us today, other than what the things that he taught. Again, what I always call it, the code words, the teachings of Jesus. When you hear a church or a para-church organization talking about the teachings of Jesus, chances are they are not Christian. It is not the teachings of Jesus that save us. It is the shed blood of Jesus as God made man that saves us. So I wrote, I mean, I'm looking through the Bible, I'm pulling out scriptures. This is all new stuff. I bought a Strong's exhaustive concordance of the Bible. My throat's sore and it's going south. If you can hear something move in my mouth, that's a throat lozenge, so I'm going to hang on as long as I can. And a Vines expository dictionary of the Bible, and I'm trying to explain to this guy how Jesus dying on the cross has anything to do with it and how it logically makes sense. The guy was a lawyer and a smart lawyer. I don't know about you guys, but I have met lawyers that I said, this guy is not as smart as he ought to be to be a lawyer. I always have this, if you're a doctor or a lawyer, you have, in my mind, or historically, until I got to know a whole bunch of them, thought that you're pretty smart. So I had to be pretty logical. I wrote a 4-page letter, and I sent it to him through distribution. About 6 months later, I hadn't seen him since then. I made sure that he got it. He goes, yep, I got the letter. And I saw him 6 months later at the post office on Okinawa. That's where you didn't have mail delivered to your house. You had to go to the post office to get it. And I saw him, and he looked at me. He knew who I was because we'd had lunch together, and we'd had this conversation. And he says, I've still got your letter. I've not read it yet, but it's sitting on my desk. And I don't know if he ever read it. I still pray for him every day. I hope to hear someday that I pray that if he was saved 7 years ago, then I pray that he's being drawn closer to you every day and he's having great fruit. But also that letter sitting on his desk, my hope is that every time he looked at that, he thought about God. And he knew that what I had done was, in my own feeble attempt, attempted to explain to him that there is a God who created the heavens and the earth, who died for us, who loves us so much that he gave his only son, because that's the only way we can spend eternity with him because of sin in our life. We had to be made perfect. Only way to be made perfect, holy, perfect sacrifice, sinless sacrifice, the only sacrifice that could meet the Old Testament requirements for a sacrifice for all people, for all time, will be a sacrifice of God himself, offered by a perfect high priest. Again, the high priest had to be greater than the sacrifice he offered. Well, in this case, the high priest was God himself, offering himself as a sacrifice. So what we're going to talk about today is the transition from the previous lessons, which basically poked holes in the theory of evolution, or the model of evolution, because I explained it as a theory. If you can't test it, you can't really call it a theory. So you can't test creation either, because we can't recreate the universe in a laboratory. So using the rules of science, the best way we call it would be two models. Again, two models have emerged, evolution and creation. We've talked about so far that evolution is a poor scientific theory or scientific model at best, impossible on its face, and then many problems as well as its mathematical and physical impossibility. So what we're going to do a little bit, and then last week was a little bit of a bridge. Again, I believe in a literal interpretation of Genesis, which is the whole basis of chapter 3 and last week's Bible study. The reason why I believe that is because on day 3, plants and trees that bear seed within itself were created and put on the earth. And if there were truly millions of years passing between each of the days mentioned in Genesis, then vegetable life or the plant kingdom had to survive for millions or tens of millions or hundreds of millions of years without sunlight to aid them in photosynthesis or to do what plants do normally. Then you've got to interject some very strange science not based on data to be able to explain that away. I'm a simple kind of person. There's a... This is actually on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire question. In the 14th century, Jason may remember this, I asked it to a couple of people on an orals board as a joke. It scared them so badly I didn't ask it anymore. But in the 14th century, there's a mathematician and theologian named William of Ockham. And he had it wasn't a theory, it was a principle. It was called Ockham's Razor. You'd think a razor like you shave your face with, but I'm not sure what that meant in the 14th century. It was called Ockham's Razor. And Ockham's Razor is that when trying to explain a phenomena in science, the simplest explanation, which accounts for all of the data, is the best and the most viable and is therefore the most scientifically appropriate one to choose. The more complex the theory, the more assumptions that are built into it, the weaker it becomes. So Occam's razor is the simplest the explanation, the better, to paraphrase. My training is in general systems theory, the study of complexity. And through that study, I know that it is best, whenever possible, to seek the simplest explanation. This is not a foundational principle of the Christian faith, the literal 7 days of creation. I just personally think it explains the data the best and is therefore the one that is most attractive to me. The problem with that, as we said last week, is that there are 24-hour periods before the sun was there, which is what our 24-hour days are based upon. Again, and the assumption that I draw into that is God is an infinite, all-knowing God, creator of space and time, could calculate 24 hours without the benefit of the sun rising and setting. So there's there is an assumption in that as well. So what we're going to look at today is, again, we've been poking holes in evolution in previous studies. So now we're going to look at some of the evidence that supports the biblical account of creation. And what I've done here is specifically used some of the ones because these are, I'll talk like a teenager for a sentence here, these are so not taught in high schools today that I think it's worth mentioning, if only to get our minds to think in a different way. Again, it's hard once you've... I was touched, there's a man in our church whose father was born in Germany, and his childhood in Germany was in the late 1930s. And if you remember that time in history, that was when Hitler was coming to power. And Hitler was very diabolically clever in some of the things that he did, but he knew that the way that he could get an entire nation to share his prejudice was to start it at a very young age. So he created Hitler Youth. And one of the things that he also did is he had Hitler Youth meet every Sunday morning. Why Sunday morning? Because that's when church was held. If he could get them away from God and listen to what he had to say, they would be able to agree with what he was doing. Now, Hitler also loved Darwinian evolution. Again, that's one of the dangers of it. It gives you a pseudo-intellectual reason for believing that some races of people are evolutionarily lower than others, and depending on how you define it, are therefore lower than a human being. And if something is lower than a human being, there are no qualms about killing it, or them, or millions of them. But to do that and to get a nation to buy into it, you've got to start at a very young age. So again, that's what Hitler did based upon Darwin evolutionary theory. So, and the same thing with the ancient Earth theory. Again, not a theory, it's a model. We can't go back and reproduce the age of the universe. It's alien to our minds in science to think that the Earth may really only be 6,000 years old. It's like you can ask, we did a chapel. I taught, which we'll do next week, I believe, out of Job chapter 40 and 41. Two animals, one the Leviathan and one the Behemoth. Read them if you've not read them. It's very interesting. And first realize that I think they should be taken literally because God is saying he's comparing what an animal is that God created. And he goes, if this animal is so great, how more great am I, the creator of that animal? So I think those animals would be taken literally. The Behemoth and Leviathan, we'll talk about them later. One sounds suspiciously like a dinosaur. And one of the kids, first grader, said, but that can't be a dinosaur because they died out long before man came on the earth. This is a, 6-year-old. And we don't teach evolution in this school. Obviously, we don't teach any science at the first grade level. They've got other things they need to learn. The world ingrains it in them at a very young age. Cartoons, again, neat show, otherwise neat shows on National Geographic or shows about dinosaurs or fossils that I would love, but you can't watch glaciers. You can't watch something for 30 seconds without them throwing in an evolutionary aspect to it, which again makes it no longer fun for me to watch it. So again, I want to get our minds to think in a different way and to use Tom's example. One way to pull your mind to think in a different way is to explain, what is the color of Tuesday? You think, days don't have colors. The purpose of such an exercise, and you'll hear lots of school metaphors on my tapes, I suspect, for as long as I'm doing them. But one of the things that we teach is a classical model of education. I'll be teaching a class in 7th grade this next year in logic. I'm going to teach classical logic. We'll probably also teach Boolean logic because that's helpful for understanding some things that computers do. But one of the things that they used to do was have to defend how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. Now they would, but they make fun of it nowadays. And, oh, look at those useful medieval model of teaching Latin and logic as they try to figure out how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. What is the root question? What is the substance of angels? Do they occupy space? If they occupy space, do they occupy mass and have volume and are therefore susceptible to the laws of science? Or are they spirit outside and therefore occupy no space, no volume, and have no mass? Some very interesting questions came in trying to figure out. And the other one would be, once you get past that, is do angels dance? So it might be a moot question. How many angels can dance on the head of a pin? Zero, because angels don't dance. I don't know, but it leads to some interesting ways of thinking. So I want you to think for a while about looking at the evidence and seeing how old the Earth is. Fact number one, the Earth's magnetic field. For those of you who don't know, my bachelor's degree is in geology, and there was quite a bit of a field component to it. So we had to go up and down canyons and rocks and do that kind of stuff with a compass. For those of you who are familiar, or if you're in the Army or the other services, I guess Navy probably uses a fancy version of a compass on ship. Satellite, yeah, it's easy. Geostationary satellites and triangulate down to within a meter. But in the old days, we used compasses. You pull out a compass, it points to magnetic north. The reason why it points to magnetic north is because the Earth has a magnetic field. It's thought, typically, that the core of the Earth is made up of nickel, or a metal similar to nickel. I'm really not sure why. Again, my guess is always the math must work if you assume it's nickel. I'm not sure why. But the core of the Earth is thought to be very hot, molten. And again, nickel is the last time that I read books dealing with the core of the Earth. And as it generates a lot of heat, it's also thought to generate the electrical currents that the Earth has. Again, that makes compasses point to magnetic north. Okay. As with everything else we talked about, again, there's the second law of thermodynamics. It says everything decays over time. As does radiation, as does or do magnetic fields. Indeed, the Earth's magnetic field, which has been measured since about 1835, is decaying. It's becoming a little bit less magnetically strong every year. And in fact, it's decaying at a measurable rate. Okay? And what we see is that it has a half-life of 830 years. What does that mean? Well, it means if you measured the strength of Earth's magnetic field today, I'm not sure what the unit is of magnetic field, but let's say it's joules. It's not, but let's say that it is. So let's say we measure today and it's 100 joules as our hypothetical unit of measure of the Earth's magnetic field. 830 years from now, it'll be half that. Did I say it was 100 just then? So 830 years from now, it would be 50 joules, if joules, again, were the measure. So every 830 years, it is half of what it was before. Okay, so that's projecting out in the future. You can also project it backwards in time, which means 830 years ago, it was twice as magnetic as it is today. Again, this is based upon observable data that's been measured for 165 years. So we've got some good data to figure out that the half-life is indeed 830 years. Okay, so that would take it back to the year 1167. The Earth's magnetic field was twice as strong as it is today. What's interesting about this is if you continue that pattern, 830 years before that it was twice as strong, 830 years before that it was twice as strong, you get to the point where at less than 10,000 years, the magnetic current of the Earth would make it a magnetic star, which is what the Sun is. It goes nuclear. It burns continually. Again, the Sun is what I was taught is the Sun is made up of helium and hydrogen, and it burns continually, and so its mass is reducing, and it's under the control of the second law of thermodynamics as well. So, if you make no assumptions other than that the magnetic decay of the Earth's magnetic field has been decaying at the same rate throughout its history, you find the Earth can't be more than 10,000 years old. Now again, evolutionists can do math too, so how do they explain this? They explain it that the Earth's magnetic field has reversed hundreds or thousands or millions of times over the Earth's 5 to 15 billion year history. And then my question would again be, what is the data to support your assertion? And the answer is not very much. Again, you can do fancy math, but it's all based on what assumptions that you make. And I think it's, you know, like they said, how did this golden calf come here? And if you remember what Aaron said in the book of Exodus, we threw in the gold and this calf came out. Well, we threw in the equation and somehow it came out that the Earth is this old. Again, it doesn't make sense. Something else had to have happened between the gold going in and the calf coming out. That is, you designed it or formed it. So again, if we assume that the Earth's magnetic field stays the same, the Earth can't be more than 10,000 years old. If you believe the Earth is more than 10,000 years old, you've got to make a whole lot of reasons to allow for the Earth's magnetic field to be changing. Now, here's what it means when the Earth's magnetic field changes. It would go from a compass pointing on magnetic north to pointing nowhere. It just doesn't work. It's just a little piece of metal floating in a bubble of liquid. And then at some point, it points magnetic south. Okay? And supposedly this happened many, 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 many times during Earth's history. A magnetic change without any physical occurrence. Again, an asteroid striking. None of that really matters if indeed, as is traditional, any evolutionary science teaches, is that if the Earth's core generating heat is what causes the current of the magnetic field. So I don't know what would cause it to change so many times. What's interesting, in the book of Joshua, if the Earth's magnetic field changed, I think maybe it changed once. If you remember that Joshua was fighting and the sun stopped for about 24 hours. If you're a student of physics, that's some real interesting physics going on there. Again, God, who created physics, could figure out a way, but it's just very neat. The all the things that would have had to happen for the Earth to stop spinning on its axis for a 24-hour period, and things not to go flying off, and just all kinds of interesting things that seems like they would happen. So again, the Earth's magnetic field seems to support the model that the Earth is less than 10,000 years old. Okay, unless it changed many times and there's an unknown mechanism for that change. It's called the reversal hypothesis. Okay, reason number two. Again, stretching our brains here, thinking about, is the Earth truly only 6,000 years old? And again, I believe that it is. I believe the Earth is exactly as old as it says in the Bible, assuming each day of creation is a literal day, which I believe. And then you can figure out how long people lived, and people have actually done calculations. Again, praise God for people that do that kind of stuff for a living and add up all the days of Methuselah and all the people that lived after him. And it shows the Earth is pretty young. The second is meteoritic dust. That is the amount of it. If you remember when man first walked on the moon, if you've ever been to the Smithsonian, you've seen the lunar module, I believe they call it, that actually landed on the moon. It's got big snowshoe-like pads on it. Why? Because when they were going to land on the moon, if the moon is extremely old, again, the moon is thought to be older than the Earth. I'm not sure if that could be so within such close proximity given the Big Bang. But anyway, the moon's thought to be older than the Earth because it seems like a dead planet, or a dead, not a planet because it's too small, it's a dead moon. And not much going on the moon. So it's thought that the moon is much older because it's given up all its heat. It's suffered heat death, which is a term in physics for things that it's a natural state after the second law of thermodynamics gets through with it. So if dust has been from the atmosphere has been landing on the moon, again, which has a very thin atmosphere, so dust lands there a lot more frequently from outer space than it does on Earth. If it's been landing there for the 15 billion plus years old that the moon is thought to be, you can do the calculations because they've estimated the amount of meteoritic dust that lands on the moon per year. Again, pretty easy to do the math. If it, you know, if it's a centimeter a year, in a million years, there should be a million centimeters plus whatever compaction is going on with a little bit heavier on top. So again, you can figure out what is known about meteoritic dust and how much it compacts, etc. Okay. So that's why Neil Armstrong says, man, we need like snowshoes. I don't want to have this lunar module land and we just keep on sinking. Like in very, very soft snow, if you were walking on stilts, you think about what happened if you're being from the mountains, you sink pretty deep until it compacts enough to hold you. So they put the pads on it. What they found out is that the amount of meteoritic dust on the moon was only about an inch or two thick. So a couple of things. One is dust hasn't been falling on the moon for, if you do the math, it comes out to less than 10,000 years. Or you got to do some fancy math to account for it and assume that the heat was a lot greater, something happened to make it rock instead of staying dust as long as it should have stayed dust. Again, with only an inch on top of it, doesn't compact very much because there's not a whole lot of wind on the moon. You know, I thought about that. I don't remember. I'm not a moon expert, but always on when you see the films of it, it doesn't look like there's any wind on the moon, but there may be some. But at any rate, two things to account for the amount of dust on the moon. The moon's only about as old as the Bible says it is, or you've got to make a lot of assumptions that are not based on data to explain why the dust is only that thick. And again, what science is all about, science at its best is predictive. That is, what's cool is when you can say, you know, if this is true, and again, my example is ballistics, if you truly do have a gun with this length of a barrel, with this heavy of a bullet, with this amount of charge, generating this much velocity, if the laws of physics hold true, and acceleration, and was it 32 feet per second is the rate of a falling object, then you can calculate how far a bullet shot out of the end of a gun is going to go and where it's going to hit and at what speed. And that works great. Again, the Navy, as I said, has been doing it a long time. If you shoot something more than a few miles away, you've got to account for the rotation of the Earth or you'll miss your target. What's also interesting is you can shoot a bullet. If you shoot it straight out sideways, again, on the moon, this only works in a vacuum. The effect of air messes it up slightly. But if you shoot a bullet perfectly sideways, and at the moment that it leaves the barrel, you drop a bullet, again, standing beside the gun from the exact same height that it left, they're going to hit the ground at the same time. It's just the laws of physics. Again, it's one of those things, it'll be cool to show seventh graders or something someday, that I'm not sure how you do that. But it's the laws of physics. And science is at its most powerful when it is predictive. So that would have indeed been a big boost for an ancient age of the Earth if it truly had been, if they'd taken core samples and found out that the dust is like a mile thick. That would have said, wow, dust has been falling for a long time, so indeed the moon must be very old. But it didn't. So again, science, in order to really be useful, I think it needs to be predictive. And evolutionary theory that we talked about before is not predictive. But as we'll see, creationism is predictive. We have a designer. We have environments. We would expect... excuse me, I didn't mean to yell there. Those listening on the tape, I'm not making a point. It's just my voice got away from me a little bit there. We would expect to find that there are animals adapted to the environments in which they were placed. Okay, so we'll see that when we look at the evidence, creation perspective makes predictions that indeed are borne out by the data. And I find in most examples, the evolutionary model and even the ancient Earth model is based upon a lot of assumptions. The more assumptions you make, the weaker your model becomes. This was always my problems with economics, because there's also a principle of economics called ceteris paribus. A paraphrase of that means, while all other variables in the entire universe remain constant, we're going to look at these two things. And when these two things change in contrast with each other, this is what's going to happen. The answer is that never happens in the real world, because those million variables you kept constant don't stay constant. They're always affecting what's going on. So again, good solid science just looks at the data and tries to figure out what went on, and you test that hypothesis and you try to figure it out. Okay. That concludes a little general science lesson. Okay, the escaping moon. The next one is, the distance between the moon and the Earth increases each year. This is a measurable phenomenon. What is it due to? It's due to the second law of thermodynamics, the law of entropy. That is, the Earth is orbiting, or it's spinning at a slightly decreasing rate. Again, as you would expect, if you've ever spun a top on the ground, even if it's got a super fine point and it's on a perfectly hard surface, you can spin it real hard. It'll spin for a long time, but eventually it's going to decay. There's friction. There's lots of things going on. Well, the same thing on a different level are working with the Earth, the Sun. Everything is undergoing entropy, again, tending towards disorder and chaos. Everything's giving up heat. And so the Earth is decreasing in the velocity that it spins around its axis at a measurable rate. Okay, and it's thought that that is why the moon is starting to move a little bit farther away. Okay, again, making an assumption, which I think is a valid assumption, that the rate that it's moving away has been the rate that it's moving away for a foreseeable period in the past, unless there are good reasons to explain why it would change its rate of spin. Okay, are you with me? That is, if it's decreasing by 35 meters a year, we'll assume that it's been decreasing by 35 meters a year for the past as well. So once again, if you do the math backwards, you find out that, make sure I get it right, at less than, if I remember right, at less than a million years, again, so a million years, you're talking 6,000 years as your model. But again, the theory of the universe is 15 to 50 billion, and then the Earth, 3 to 15 billion, depending on who you talk to. A million years shoots every theory of evolution totally out of the water. If the Earth were indeed only 1 million years old. Again, personally, I think it's only 6,000 years old. But if you look at the escaping moon, the rate of the moon is moving away from the Earth, you extrapolate back far less than a million years ago. I saw Pastor Ron sent to me, it was really cute. One guy did the math and said about 8,000 years ago, or no, it wasn't 8, it was, I don't remember the math, 20 to 30,000 years ago, it said the moon would have been so close to the Earth that it would have only been 30 feet away. And it said, and this accounts for the extinction of the dinosaurs, comma, or the very tall ones, at least. That they bonked their heads on it and knocks them out. But really what would happen is if the moon got that close to the Earth, the gravitational forces of the Earth, and again, gravity, would tear the moon apart. It busted up into rubble. It's not like they'd bonk together, just the physics of it wouldn't work out. So we would have, in fact, the rings of Saturn, have you ever seen that? It's kind of cool. In fact, I've got a telescope. It's all covered with dust now. I haven't looked at it in about 5 years, but you could actually look through the telescope and use the high-powered lens, and you could see the rings around Saturn. It was really cool. You had to keep moving the telescope because, of course, the Earth is rotating. It's a neat thing, but if you ever look through a telescope and say, oh, look, there, right there, and say, it's moving. You think, man, if I got it, clamped down tight, well, it's tight, but the Earth's rotating while you're doing it. So you got to kind of move the telescope. But it's thought that the rings around Saturn were once a moon that got broken up because perhaps it got too close and just turned into rubble, and all those pieces of rubble went into orbit. Again, that's one thought on the rings of Saturn. So the escaping moon, again, if we assume that it's been escaping at the same rate in the past, not too long ago, it would have been very close to the Earth, and therefore is evidence to show that perhaps the moon hasn't been in orbit around the Earth all that long after all. Okay, helium in Earth's atmosphere. Next topic for your perusal. Radioactive deposits. Again, radioactive elements. They're unstable. That means they're always giving off ions, and they're becoming radioactive. You've read comic books. You're familiar with radioactivity. And there's a cool thing. At least there's a way that they explain how neat mutations happen. Remember Spider-Man? Spider-Man, if I remember right, the way that he got his spider powers is he was bit by a spider about the same time in the chemistry lab a whole bunch of chemicals fell on him. And he underwent, at least that was in the late 1960s. They may have made it more cool since then, but this is the Spider-Man that I grew up with. And he got all these spider powers, and then he invented the web shooter thing. But at least there's a fruitious mutation. Well, there you go. Spider bit him, the right chemicals fell on him, became Spider-Man. So radioactivity. The Incredible Hulk became Incredible Hulk through gamma rays, I believe, before we knew very much about gamma rays. It was kind of like in Star Trek, they called them phasers instead of lasers because they thought, well, here in a couple of years, someone will say, hey, lasers can't do that, so we'll call them phasers, which don't exist. They'll say, they could be. We don't know what's causing that. So helium, I'm not sure how I got digressed into that. Oh, radioactivity. But radioactive elements, what happens is, as they go through decay, they give off helium. That's common in many radioactive minerals and deposits. And they give off helium at a known rate. So once again, you can figure out how many or how much volume of helium is being emitted through radioactive decay every year. And since helium doesn't go away, it just tends to leak out of the crust because helium wants to go into the atmosphere. Again, the principle of a helium balloon. Why? It's lighter than air because it wants to go up. So helium that is in the ground, it's lighter than air, so it tends to find its way up through the crust and go in the atmosphere, as does radiogenic helium, which is helium that is generated when radioactive rocks decay and going to decay at a known rate. Okay, it's also found that the Earth's atmosphere holds in the helium. Very little helium escapes out through the atmosphere. It's like hitting if helium is in a balloon, helium tends to stop when it hits the edge of the rubber balloon, unless the balloon pops and it goes wherever. So that's kind of the Earth's atmosphere, the outer atmosphere, acts in the same way with helium. Helium tends to stay in the atmosphere. Okay. How is that relevant or important? Well, if we know how much helium is generated every year through radioactive decay, and we know that helium stays in the atmosphere once it's there, we should be able to figure out if the Earth is 3 billion years old and if radiogenic helium, again, helium emitted from radiation, is being emitted at a known rate. We should be able to figure out how much helium should be in the atmosphere. Well, when we do the math, we find out that there should be about 10 to the 6th or 1 million more 1 million times more helium than in the atmosphere than there is. Again, this is even assuming that all the helium in the atmosphere is radiogenic helium, that it all came from radioactive decay, and in fact, probably it all came from a number of other sources as well. Okay. So, the amount of radiogenic helium in the atmosphere suggests that helium has only been leaking out of deposits, being emitted by deposits, for about 6 to 10,000 years. That would account for the amount of helium in the atmosphere. Again, if the Earth had been billions of years old and helium had been generated through these radioactive deposits for billions of years, there should be a whole lot more helium in the atmosphere than there is. So again, another piece to show that perhaps the Earth isn't as old as we've been taught. The Mississippi River Delta, this is kind of interesting. Again, in geology school, I was taught that the Mississippi River was perhaps one of the, if not the oldest river on Earth. And here's what's kind of interesting. The Grand Canyon, right? I believe the Colorado River that runs through it. It's thought to be just a young pup of a river. Why? Because it's dug straight down. It was thought, again, there's two opposing theories on this. One is that rivers dig straight down and then they meander. Well, have you ever seen, well, actually, I've not ever been in the Mississippi River, but I've flown over it a number of times, and it meanders all over the place. In fact, there's the Mississippi River Valley, which is a very rich and fertile valley because it's got all the sediment from the Mississippi River, and it's very flat. I bet it floods like crazy when the Mississippi's at flood stage. But and it's very flat, the land around it, again, the flood valley of the Mississippi is very wide, miles and miles and miles. So it's thought that the Mississippi River is ancient. Again, one of the most ancient on Earth when I was going to geology school. Okay. Again, there's a measurable amount of sediment, that is sand and silt, that goes out of the Mississippi River and is deposited into the Gulf of Mexico. It's called a delta. The delta, again, it's a triangle shape. Well, a delta is also a geological phenomena that happens when a river is dumping something into the ocean. It makes a delta. Again, it's shaped like the Greek symbol, the delta, which is a triangle. That's what it makes, is a big triangle. Okay, the Mississippi dumps 300 million cubic yards into the Gulf of Mexico each year. And we've been measuring the Mississippi for over 100 years, and so we know some years there's dry years and it does less. Some years there's flood years and it deposits more. So we know an approximate rate that the Mississippi deposits sediments into the Gulf of Mexico. So we can take the math backwards and we find out that when we do core samples, that is in the Gulf of Mexico and near there, when you drill down and figure out how much sediment has been deposited in that delta with a known rate of deposition, you can figure out about how long it's been deposited. Are you with me? If it deposits, again, 300 million cubic yards over a certain amount of area, let's say that winds up being 10 foot thick. So let's say every year the Mississippi deposits 10 feet thick worth of sediment in the Gulf of Mexico. Well, you just add up the numbers of tens of feet, and you can figure out how many years it's been deposited in there. So what we find out is that the Mississippi has apparently only been depositing sediment in the Gulf of Mexico at its known rate for about 4,000 years. So what could explain it? It's only been there for about that, or it's not as ancient as they thought, or maybe it was dry for billions of years old, and then it started again. But again, then you can't say it's ancient, because what makes a river meander back and forth, again, is water running through it. So again, it doesn't work. The math doesn't work with the Mississippi unless you assume that it is indeed only 4,000 years old. Petroleum and natural gas. Just as helium, like in a balloon, wants to go up in the air, so does natural gas wants to go up into the air, and so does petroleum when it is under great pressure and heat. It's looking for a way out. Again, the best way to think of it is a glass bottle full of very hot cola with a cork stuck in the top. You heat it up and shake it up long enough, that cork's going to come out. Well, think of oil and natural gas deep in the earth under great pressure and the permeable or impermeable cap on top of it is the cork. It's only going to stay under there for a certain amount of time and it's going to come out. The Stanley Steamer, one of the early automobiles, one of the problems with it is, by golly, you heat steam hot enough and you don't give it a way to escape quickly enough, it's going to find a way out and it would explode the engine. That's what liquids and gases do under pressure. So what's interesting, and here's, again, perhaps something new, One is, again, when you do the math, you find out that if we assume the heat and pressure are approximately constant, 10,000 years is about the maximum period of time that the cork can stay on the bottle, or in this example, that the permeable rock can stay on top of the deposits of liquid petroleum and natural gas. What's also interesting now is, again, I was taught that it takes millions and millions of years for oil to form and for coal to form. But if you've got a flood with rapid deposition of lots of layers of dirt on top of it, it can form in a very short period of time, and as little as a few years, and in the laboratory, as little as 20 minutes. You can take microscopic, it's usually algae. I was taught that the petroleum was formed through the fossilization, or basically, again, heat and pressure of microscopic, like plankton or green algae, and that turned into petroleum. Whether it was leaves or whatever, I still think it's a little unclear on exactly what it was that decomposed to form petroleum. But now we find that we can create petroleum in laboratory conditions, again, estimating the heat and temperature inside the earth, you know, again, down 5,000-10,000 feet, and you can create it in 20 minutes. Coal, the same thing. Coal is a little easier to figure out. It's leaves and bark and bits of wood and stuff. Under heat pressure, it becomes coal. And then if you're, again, maybe I'm the only one that read comic books when I was a kid, but Superman could take a piece of coal and he'd put it in his hands. Do you remember what had happened? He'd squeeze it, put it on a great heel, and a diamond would come out. Because coal is pure carbon, depending on how pure you get it, and diamonds are pure carbon. The difference is heat and pressure, in which Superman could simulate in his hand. And, of course, it would be a cut diamond because he's Superman. Well, the same thing, in laboratory, in just a few hours, wood and debris can be made into coal. So it doesn't take millions of years for those deposits to form. There are a whole lot. I said here there are 100 different ones. I looked at all those. There are a lot of theories and models which point towards a young age of the Earth, but some, again, I find to not be very rigorous models either. So, again, I want to be careful on trying to present, you know, the evidence. And if it doesn't appear to be evidence to support either one, then it shouldn't be talked about. The one thing that I believe I did perhaps mention earlier, one of the evidences for an old Earth, two things that have struck me for a long time, until about maybe a year ago, as evidence for an ancient Earth, is one is that light from stars has reached us, stars that are 100 million light years away. So by definition, it took that light 100 million years to reach from that star to me. So that would seem to infer that it's at least 100 million years old. Or as I explained, or as I didn't explain, for God stretched the light in the creative act from the star to us. Or the other example is there is some evidence that points that the speed of light is decaying as well as everything else in nature, which would mean that perhaps 6,000 to 8,000 years ago, the speed of light was much quicker. So if you think of it being infinitely fast, as soon as the star was born, as soon as God created it, the light would have immediately reached Earth if the light was traveling infinitely fast instead of 186,280 miles per second as it does today. So, or God stretched it and made it happen so that we could see it. Otherwise, we'd pretty much never see most of the stars in the heavens. The other one is the formation, if you've ever been to caves, the formation of stalactites and stalagmites, because they would say this grows at a half a centimeter a year. And doing the math back, that's been growing for 50 million years. Couple things for that. One is, or there was a great flood, and so that accelerated the process. Or two is, what's interesting, there are now being found, what it is calcite, like limestone in different crystals is what makes stalactites and stalagmites. They're really cool to look at. But there's also microscopic animals that create that as well. So when you include that in the equation, it forms a lot quicker than it does if it's happening by dripping alone. So the bottom line is, whether it's young or old, the evidence supports that the Bible is true, and as we'll talk about next week, the Bible, when it speaks on issues of science, it's absolutely accurate before the scientist of the day had it. The last thing to talk about that I didn't write it up is population. If the Earth is billions of years old, human population tends to increase. That is, two people tend to have more than two people. Even assuming sickness, where, again, like in the 1800s, where you had to have lots of kids because a bunch of them would die before they reached the age of marriage to have other offspring. But it's kind of interesting. If you assume that it increases at only 2% a year, and if the Earth is only 10 million years old, there should be hundreds of trillions of people on the Earth instead of 6 billion that there are now. Again, this is even so, you're forgetting about plagues and wars. And this is even assuming that every 500 years, something happens to wipe out half the people on Earth. And it continues at 2% a year. 500 years later, great plague wipes out half the people on Earth. Even making those assumptions, there should be a lot more people on Earth than there are today. This is assuming scarcity of food and all that. It's a really interesting way to create these computer models. But so you can use population growth. Again, there's any of a number of ways. But again, the key is, look at the evidence. Assume the Bible's true. Don't assume science is true. The more that I learned about science, the less faith I began to have in it. Because I started to know some of the people that wrote some of the articles and said, this guy's a knucklehead. He's so hard up on proving what he thinks is important that he's overlooking major flaws with what he's doing. But it's because they're people, like everybody else. Again, pastors' conferences, you find out, wow, people, they're just people. So it's a... But God is still God, and His Word is true. And next week we'll begin to see what the Bible has to say about creation. Let's close in prayer.